Target 99%ers, this is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to continue in our shows in which we've been discussing three great economists here and debunking a lot of the falsifications that you find in mainstream economics and pundit business press about what these economists have said. We've spent three shows here explaining first what Keynes' economics is really about. They're not Keynesian. Go back and listen to them if you're interested in that. And then last week we started our explanation of what Marx actually said and not what contemporary critics of Marx say Marx said, or even what contemporary Marxist economists say Marx said. In other words, we're going back to the original source and looking at it ourselves and not relying on third parties to give you their interpretation. Okay, to recapitulate briefly what the topic discussion was last week, what we did was point out that Marx's economics is really about long-run supply-side analysis of the evolution and change of capitalist economies. Emphasize here, long-run supply-side, meaning he looks at the process of production. That's the key to the evolution of capitalism. What goes on in the production process, not on the market side, in production. And by the way, to digress a little bit here, that's exactly what Smith did as well. You know, the contemporary commentary on Smith is in classical economics is, oh, it's about markets. No, no, no. As we'll see when we get to Smith, he starts out with the production process. And markets expand that, but it's production that is the key to capitalist economy. Well, Marx simply develops on that idea. The key is production. All of classical economics, which I argue Marx is the final culmination of, really is about supply side, production, capitalist production. Now, what Smith does is pretty much focus on how capitalist production leads to more and more output, and that leads to more and more product and wealth. What Marx does is the same thing, but focuses on how that leads to a breakdown of capitalist production and evolution. Two different conclusions about where capitalist economy leads. One in Smith leads to ever higher growth in wealth, i.e. the Wealth of Nations, the name of his book. And Marx, yes, it leads to more and more wealth, but leads to contradictions and a crisis, and therefore a breakdown eventually. But both are long-run supply-side. Supply-side meaning we're focusing on production as the driver here. Okay. Now, what Marx does with classical economics is focus on exploitation of labor as the driving force within that long-run supply-side development of the economy. Exploitation of labor. Marxism is an exploitation theory of the movement and development of capital and capitalist production. Key is exploitation. Now, that did not exist in Smith and classical economists. But Marx derives that from borrowing from classical economists the concept that labor value is the source of all value, the source of all production. Labor and the value, labor produces all the value. Now, that's, of course, we know that's at the core of Marx's analysis, but, you know, most folks don't realize that Adam Smith and Ricardo and others said the same thing. Labor is the source of all value. Now, you go back to the 18th century, when you were talking about Smith and others, they looked around, and that's exactly what they saw. You know, it was labor that took resources from nature, from the land, and transformed it into products, into goods. 18th century is an explosion of production of new things. New things. Before that, it was sort of just taking from agriculture, taking from from nature itself. And yes, there were some things that were produced, you know, like castles and homes and ships and so forth. But it was not the driving force. Agriculture was the driving force, just taking from nature. But in 18th century, we have the creation of new power source with coal and steam, and now we can produce machinery and produce all kinds of things. Well, when we get to Smith, we'll explain how Smith emphasized that and said, well, his economic predecessors, economist predecessors called mercantilists, did not understand that, that production of things is the source of all wealth. Now, how that wealth gets distributed among the different sources, capitalist, workers, right? Aristocracy, landed aristocracy is still a factor in 18th century, is another question, right? And classes, in other words, were how it got distributed. And that's Smith. You know, that's the early classical economists. Now, what Marx does is say, okay, classes, let's go deeper and explain how that distribution gets maldistributed and how that is linked to this idea of exploitation in production of labor, which is the source of all value. So Marx is a labor theory of value, of exploitation of capitalism, and that's how the system evolves. Now, in Marx, as we said last week, Volume 1 is only published edition of an anticipated 8 volumes of Capital, right? Volume 1, right, talks only about value in production. Labor is the source of all value. How is value created and then divvied up between capitalists and workers in the production process? Labor theory of value. He's not talking about price. He had planned to talk about how value becomes price later on, but he never got to that and opened himself to some criticism called the transformation problem, how value, exploitation of value, becomes exploitation based upon price. In other words, price variables are wages and profits. Those are market price concepts. In the production process, we're talking about surplus value, a predecessor to profits, and, of course, socially necessary value, what workers get, which becomes in the marketplace wages. So we've got even more fundamental concepts below and at the core of profits and wages in Volume 1 of Capital, because we're only talking about value. Now, Marx will later point out, as Smith and the classicalists did, a two-price theory, right? Two-price theory. What is that? Okay, Marx will say that value at the core of a product is really the natural price, and that when it hits the market, you get a market price, and that market price may be more or less than its natural price. Natural price is, you know, the same as value. So we have this concept of value at the core of a product when it sells in the market. And that core, of course, is value, the natural price of the product, around which the market price fluctuates. Now, that's Adam Smith. That's not just Marx. That's Adam Smith. That was a concept in classical economics because they saw that everything was produced only by labor. And it was much easier to see then, you see, because things were much simpler in production. But that's a concept that Marx borrows from classical economics. You know, we have value, natural price, and we have market price fluctuating around value. In the long run, the two would be equal. natural price value and market price would be equal in the long run. That's an assumption. In the short run, market price fluctuates around natural price value. Okay, so in other words, Marx borrows an awful lot from classical economics in terms of the conceptual framework used to analyze capitalism. That's why I say Marx is the final statement of classical economics and its particular framework of analysis, which is really long-run supply-side production analysis of the economy. As we said last week, Marx adds to this borrowing of concepts from classical economics. He adds to this his Hegelian philosophy approach, which uses the dialectic concept. In other words, he strips out Hegel's assumption that ideas drive the material world, and he says, no, the material world determines and produces ideas. So he strips it out, and he uses the dialectic, and he adapts that to his early philosophical training, which was about materialist philosophy from the ancient Greeks. So we have this philosophical element in Marx, materialism, we have the dialectic from Hegel, and we have the borrowing of many concepts, economics, bourgeois economics, whatever you want to call it, from Smith and the classical economists. Those three put together, plus he adds the whole class struggle political element to it all. So those are the origins that we talked about last week. But the conceptual framework borrowed from the classicalists include concepts that I've said, labor is the source of all value. Productive labor only is the source of all value. In other words, labor that produces things, because wealth is things. Surplus value is what is extracted from labor's total value. The capitalist extracts that surplus. When he sells his product, he gets a profit on that surplus value he's extracted. And social averages. Marx uses social averages. In other words, you can't look at a particular occupation or particular worker and analyze how much labor has been exploited and extracted from them. You got to use a common denominator. And the common denominator is the social average. The social average, of course, is what he calls the socially necessary labor, a conceptual innovation by Marx, which is really based upon the classical iron law of wages, but we won't get there. I don't want to get too much of a digression, but that's another concept that Marx borrows from the classicalists, and he transforms its meaning, and he uses that transformed meaning for his analysis. So he's taking the conceptual framework of classical economics to a higher level, and all great economists do this. They borrow from their predecessors concepts, then they innovate on those concepts by adapting and changing those concepts and their meaning, or introducing totally new concepts, or sometimes just rejecting outright some of the concepts of their predecessors. Keynes did that, Marx is doing that, and we'll see that Smith did that as well. Socially necessary labor is an important new concept in Marx. What is it? Socially necessary labor is what it takes to reproduce a worker and his family at a given time. What it takes, in other words, what kind of income does a worker have to be enabled to, on average, live and reproduce himself, raise a family, whatever. That's socially necessary. And how much time does a worker have to work in order to get enough wage in order to reproduce his family? On an average. Now, some workers will do much better. They'll be above the average. And some workers will be below the average. They will be the poor and those who are barely making it. And we can see that today, can't we? We got tech workers who are doing quite well, right, in technology. making well above $50,000 a year. Some of them in the new areas of technology making $100,000, $200,000 a year. Well, they're above what's socially necessary average to reproduce themselves and their family. But then you've got workers who are really struggling part-time, you know, barely in service jobs, barely making it, and going backwards, essentially almost starving. And starving defined here is not the average food consumption, quality and quantity, right? So you have those below and those above, but the average of that is what's socially necessary social to reproduce a worker. Now, as Marx will say, that varies in time and place. Historically, what the socially necessary labor is has risen significantly in the U.S. And elsewhere, and even in the third world. It's less than it was, I mean, more than it was more a century ago. So it's time-wise, historically, it's risen. SNL, socially necessary labor, has risen. Culturally, it's determined as well. Certain cultures have a higher requirement of average standard of living. So socially necessary labor, important concept, defines how much of the total value produced by workers that the workers actually get, you see, and that can rise in absolute terms over time. Now, exploitation will rise over time as well because the surplus that's produced rises even faster. So you have this concept that is contrary to critiques of Marx, that the standard of living of workers can rise, but their rate of exploitation rises even faster. So workers can be better off than they were 50, 100 years ago, but their exploitation is more intense. Capitalism figures out how to get even more while it gives them more, but not as much as the capitalists take. The surplus value the capitalists take is even greater than what it gives to the workers. So you don't have to have absolute impoverization to have increasing exploitation, you see. And Marxism is an exploitation theory of labor as the key to driving the evolution of capitalism. Okay, now, Marx's conceptual innovations, you know, social averaging here, SNL, socially necessary. And the big innovation is using time as a proxy for defining value and value extraction quantitatively. You see, one of the criticisms of Marx was, okay, value. How do you measure value? You got to measure it if you're going to say exploitation is increasing, right? How do you measure it? And that's what critics of Marx were saying. Well, Marx says you measure it in terms of time. Time is the proxy for price as the measurement of labor value exploitation. When we are at this early stage of Marx's analysis, when we are at a high level of abstraction and generalization, and therefore using value theory in Volume 1 of Capital, he had planned in subsequent 7 volumes of Capital to move from the general to the more particular, from the abstract to the more concrete. That's Hegelian approach, you see. You go from the general, particular, absolute, concrete, quantitative change to qualitative change, etc. That's all Hegelian logic, you see. But it's been materialized. It's stripped of its ideological nature. It's not about ideas driving, right? So Marx's conceptual innovation on classical economics, not only social averaging, but time as a proxy for quantifying value, right? And then he explains how value, using the time proxy, using concepts of socially necessary labor and surplus value, how the capitalists actually extract value in the process of production, right? from labor. And that's where we come to the core of Volume 1 of Capital. And the key new concepts also of Marx, absolute surplus value extraction and relative surplus value extraction. Now, this is really the key to Volume 1 of Capital. Even though we're still at the level of value, not price, it really rings true to workers, you know, who happen to read Capital Volume 1 and get past the early abstractions of value theory. And I know this is what my boss is doing to me, right? He's making me work longer. In other words, absolute surplus value. Or he's making me work harder, more intense, relative surplus value. But he's not paying me any more than my socially necessary average. Right? I'm not getting more. But he is sure producing more goods. He's doing that by making me work harder, intensifying production, producing more in a given workday, or he's lengthening the workday. Now, okay, so the workday is not lengthening today. In fact, capitalism, the critics argue, has reduced the workday. But back in Marx's time, the mid-19th century, the workday was being expanded. You see, capitalism was in its most crude and exploited form, and people were working 10, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. 12 hours a day, 6 days a week was normal, right? And the worker was getting just the minimum to survive. I mean, read Charles Dickens and so forth, you know, you get a good picture of the conditions in particularly England, because, you know, what Marx is writing about is mid-19th century capitalism as he sees it, and especially British capitalism, which was, the most advanced at the time. Of course, now we got global capitalism and various forms elsewhere, so it's much more complex. But anyway, absolute surplus value, lengthening the workday, paying the workers no much more, just what they need to survive, which, by the way, is a derivation from a classical economics concept called the iron law of wages, that wages were paid simply based upon the long-run supply of workers. When you had a crisis and workers died off, according to the iron law wages, then the labor supply declined. And if you have a reduction in supply, the price goes up, right? The price goes up for labor. Wages, workers got more wages. They were able to increase their family. Then you got an oversupply of labor, and that reduced the price of labor wages, and that's how things evolved. And the classical economists did not believe that workers could ever get more than the minimum based upon a long-run labor supply. Marx, takes that concept, and that's from which he derives and innovates on and creates his socially necessary labor. It's an average. But the average in Marx can rise, you see. It can rise, as we said a minute ago. So exploitation is not just crude immiseration driving down wages to starvation level. Wages can be rising, and exploitation can be rising even faster. That's Marx's exploitation theory. Okay, so absolute and relative surplus value are the key concepts of how surplus value is extracted by the capitalist. Absolute surplus value, how the workday is extended while not paying workers more than their social necessary average. Right? Relative surplus value, how within a given workday in terms of hours, whatever that might be, within that time, intensifying, producing more products, and getting workers to work harder two ways. That's relative surplus value. Now, in the 20th century, what we have is this whole trend of the absolute surplus value, the hours of work, being reduced. You know, we went from the 12-hour, 6-day a week to the 40-hour, 5-day week, 8-hour day, and penalties on working overtime, you know, with minimum wage laws and unions, you know, in the early half of the 20th century, raising the wages of their members. We had, and reducing the work day, and also, you know, labor contracts, paid time off for vacations, paid time off for sick leave, for holidays and so forth. That's all reducing the work day, reducing it. Okay, so that was a trend. Now, that trend has been reversing since the 1980s, and we'll explain later in the show examples of how absolute surplus value extension of the workday has been underway for the last several decades. Yeah, so we've reversed the reduction in the first half of the 20th century of the workday, and the absolute workday is expanding, growing once again. And that means surplus value is being extracted in absolute terms once again, as Marx had predicted. The forms in which it's taken today, of course, he could not see. He was looking at the labor force and the workday 150 years ago. Okay. Now, relative surplus value is expanding even faster today, especially once again since the 1980s and the advent of neoliberal policies. More intensification and producing of goods and products in the same period of time than ever before. Sometimes we identify that as automation, you see. Or it's essentially the displacement of workers by machinery and technology. That increases productivity, which is what we sometimes call relative surplus value, as well. Increasing productivity. And, you know, if you use the proxy of productivity for relative surplus value, what you see is productivity has been rising in the last 40 years dramatically, but workers' wages have not kept up with the productivity. Even bourgeois statistics provide this evidence. You know, it's well known that wages have not increased equivalent to the productivity. Well, that means exploitation has been increasing. That capitalist is keeping a greater share of the productivity and giving even less to the workers, even though the workers' standard of living may be rising. However, you know, even contemporary statistics in the United States show that's not so. You know, since 1982, the real wage adjusted for inflation has not risen. In fact, it's fallen, the real wage. While productivity has been increasing dramatically and is accelerating. Okay, so that's even contemporary evidence of relative surplus value intensifying. Now, what drives all of that, the productivity, relative surplus value extraction intensifying, lengthening the workday now going on once again, what drives that? Well, Marx introduced the concepts of forces of production. Those are the underlying key drivers of capitalist exploitation and the evolution of the capitalist system. Technology and science, Marx even in his day identified as a key force of production. Of course, he didn't know how important it would become, increasingly important, and it's the key to capitalist evolution today, technology and science behind technology. Capitalists have really captured science and technology and are using it like never before to intensify their exploitation of labor, to increase their surplus value and thus their profits. But other forces of production were the population, the quality and quantity of labor, the skills and experience of the labor force, the quality and quantity of capital, and even ideas, if they became materialist forces, you know, in society, could become force of production, even ideas. Okay, not in a Hegelian sense, you know, as a consequence of materialist change, they become material themselves. Okay, and Marx also distinguished between modes of production. Modes, in other words, how surplus value was extracted from the producers. You know, in Roman times, we had the slave mode of production. That's how they extracted a value from the producers. This is mostly agricultural, right? And then in the medieval times, we had serfdom. The serf wasn't a slave, but he was exploited even more efficiently than slave production. That's how the system evolved during medieval times. But within the source of medieval economy, the new mode was being born. The capitalists were beginning to emerge and evolve more and more powerfully within the towns and the cities. And eventually, they became more wealthy and more powerful than the landed aristocracy and overthrew that aristocracy and really gave birth to a generalized evolution of capitalist production, capitalist mode of production, in which the serfs were replaced by workers and wage labor. Each form of labor producers was more free. In other words, the slave, of course, was not free. The serf was more free than the slaves, but still not totally free, was bound to the land. The landed lord did not own the serf, but he owned some of his time of production. And then the workers, the capitalists don't own the workers at all. The workers can starve. They don't have to work if they don't want to, right? But when you do work, the capitalist owns your time and can tell you what to do. When you enter the workplace, you give up your freedom. You do it voluntarily. You don't have to work, right? But you give up your freedom, 1/3 of your life. Another third you sleep, and 1/3, okay, you're free. So capitalism is even more free than its the workers, than their preceding forms of the mode of production. They're even more free. That's why capitalism, you know, one of its main driving ideological terms is freedom. Freedom. Yes, they were more free than the serfs, right? But you're as free to starve if you don't want to. Okay, so modes of production evolve over time. Again, here's the Hegelian concepts that come in of the dialectic. In other words, things that evolve develop their own contradictions naturally, endemically, inherently, and those contradictions come in conflict and clash with the original source from which they evolved, and out of that clash comes a new synthesis, a new higher level, qualitatively new higher level. Of evolution. And Marx takes that Hegelian concept and explains that's how we move from slave to slave mode, to serf mode, to capitalist mode, and eventually we'll move to a socialist mode in the final analysis. But Marx explains there's nothing guaranteed, you know, it's not determined that this will happen. It will only happen if the new vehicle of the evolution of the working class organizes economically and politically and challenges the capitalists for defining what the new mode of production will be. And this can take centuries to occur and give and take and ebb and flow of the relationship of political power between capitalists and the working class can take years. Just as the capitalists themselves took centuries to evolve within the context of the feudal mode, the landed lords and aristocracy to eventually emerge more powerful than the landed aristocracy and overthrow them and take their place and transform the feudal mode into a pure capitalist mode. These modes of production can coexist for a long time. And, you know, we kind of got that today. We kind of got like quasi-socialist modes, not purely capitalist, or both coexisting, you know, in China, in Cuba, and places like that, right? You had it for a while in the old Soviet Union, but that, you know, had its problems and imploded internally. It couldn't keep up with the changes in the forces of production in the capitalist side of the global economy. Okay, so the idea that the working class must organize economically and politically to challenge capitalists is a key innovation concept of Marx, but also that the capitalists themselves, over time, as the contradictions grew, would not be able to resolve those contradictions, would not be able to resolve growing inequality, for example, right? Would not be able to resolve, in other words, solve the problem of climate change, perhaps, right? Would not be able to resolve the problem of constant wars or problems of health that we're seeing now with COVID and so forth, you know? The capitalists must fail in the eyes of the general populace as the source of resolution of the contradictions and crises before the working class can actually take over. There has to be an awareness, general awareness, that they can't solve the problems, that things are just getting worse. Only then, if the working class is adequately organized economically and politically, can you have the beginning of a transformation, which will occur in stages, not all at once. It won't be some great political epiphany where, okay, the capitalists are wiped out and all the workers take over. No, no. The two will exist side by side for quite some time in different forms and different places. So at the center of Marx is this idea that capitalism breaks down. It's about a long-run supply-side breakdown of capitalism. Marxist economics is not about recessions or depressions. Those are short-run developments in the system, not long-run breakdown. Marxism is about the breakdown thesis of capitalism. That occurs because of these contradictions. And Marx will develop in volumes 2 and 3 of Capital the notion what Smith called the steady state. In other words, inherent within capitalism was this tendency that Smith did not really explain or analyze, but sort of observed that, you know, it seems that the system just slows down, that it can't increase productivity and output as it did at one point, and the whole thing moves towards a steady state, or in Ricardo's sense, a stationary state. The classical economists saw this, but they didn't explain it because they weren't really interested in explaining it. They were interested in explaining how the system just keeps growing in the long run. You see, you get trapped in a long run supply side approach, being unable to look at the short run and the short run crises that occur. Now, you know, digression, that's kind of what Keynes was doing too, right? You know, economic analysis before Keynes, which was still closely influenced by long run analysis on the macro side, macroeconomic side, could not explain what was going on in the Depression of the 1930s, because it was really an attempt to take concepts that looked at the long run and try to use those concepts to explain the short-run depression. It couldn't do it. The conceptual framework was inadequate to do it. So Keynes comes along, and he innovates on that conceptual framework and explains why you have this short-run depression. And he creates new concepts and so forth, right? So the same thing happened with Keynes here. You know, you can apply that to Marx and his analysis. He doesn't explain short-run crises any more, you know, than Smith really did. He's explaining a long-run breakdown. But within Marx is this concept innovation called the organic composition of capital, which it kind of points in the direction of the steady state idea. In other words, explaining Smith's steady state, why the system just sort of stagnates at one point with new concepts, organic composition of capital. But that's in volume two, you see. That's not really what Marx produced in volume one. But it's worth mentioning here, and we'll talk about it more next week when we talk about theories of crises in Marxist analysis even further, and debunk some of contemporary Marxist economists' notions like the falling rate of profit tendency theory. But that's for next week, right? Okay, so just keep in mind, organic composition of capital is a concept that's closely related to the steady state, stationary state, that goes further than Smith and Ricardo, and explaining why capitalism stagnates, i.e., breaks down. Okay, so, you know, the key to step back here, at the center of all this that I've just explained, is how surplus value is extracted by the capitalists, and there's two forms of that. Relative surplus value and absolute surplus value. So let's look at what's going on today in terms of absolute surplus value and relative surplus value. You know, critics of Marx will say, "Oh, the workday is not being extended." Right? In fact, we got a shorter workday. Yeah, it was shortened in the first half of the 20th century. You know, maybe even up to the 1970s and 80s, but capitalists figured out a new way, various ways, of extending the workday. Extend the workday, create more surplus value, don't pay workers much more than they were getting, or maybe pay them more, but extend the workday and you can get even more surplus value, even while you're paying the workers more. Okay, so how is that happening today? What are the forms of rising absolute surplus value? Well, look at it, right? The shift from hourly wage to salary. Now, in a salary, right, you're paid a flat amount during the week or month, right? You're paid a flat amount. Professionals of all kinds do not work on an hourly basis. And you expand the state, capitalist state expands the definition of professional, so those workers get exempt from an hourly pay. If you're exempt from an hourly pay, the capitalist can get you to work longer, more hours without paying you, right? So the more that shift from hourly pay, the salary pay, do not get overtime pay. You see, overtime pay, part of the minimum wage laws passed in 1938 in the U.S., was designed to put a penalty on capitalists if they wanted to make you work more hours. Well, the capitalists get around that by simply redefining people as salaried and exempt from overtime pay. And that adding more to the category of exempt salaried workers than the state aids capitalists in doing that has been a strong trend. You know, under George W. Bush, 6 million people who were on overtime, hourly pay, were simply redefined. And, of course, when the government redefines it, they are exempt, then the capitalists put them on a salary rather than a hourly paid basis, and they don't have to pay unemployment. Okay, here's some other forms of what's going on in terms of exploitation based on lengthening of the workday. Reduction of vacation pay time and holiday pay time. Yeah, in the U.S., we've been moving in the opposite direction that we were in the first half 20th century. We've been reducing holiday pay time and reducing vacation time. You know, Americans work have the least amount of paid vacation of any workers in the industrial world. Yeah, barely 2 weeks. Whereas if you go to Europe and Japan and places like that, you know, they get 3-4 weeks of vacation time. 4 weeks is normal in Europe, right? In Europe, normal 15 to 20 paid holidays. In the U.S., 7, 8 maybe paid holidays. Is there paid sick leave? In some cases, if you're a public worker in the public sector and you have a union, or if you still have a union in some of the private sector, you'll get paid sick leave, but there's no national paid sick leave in the United States. We've moved in the opposite direction here. That's exploitation of labor. Well, how? Well, because even if you have 7 days of holiday, if you work it, then the capitalists give you comp time. In other words, oh, okay, you worked here on the Sunday of July, or let's say, well, Christmas or something like that, right? Okay, you worked, you're able to take another day off with pay, right? Because you worked, well, I'm going to pay you straight time working on Christmas, but you can get another paid day off. Well, you get a paid day off, but you don't get it at time and a half, right? They're saving the overtime once again. Another example, paid break times. We know in many occupations, you know, you're supposed to have paid breaks. You don't take them. You don't get them, right? Part-time work. Here's a big one, right? I, the capitalist, right? Instead of having you work full-time, 40 hours a week, 35, 40 hours a week, right? What I do is have you work part-time. I only have you work 15 or 20 hours a week. When I do that, I don't have to pay you benefits, which is usually 25, 30% of your equivalent wage. I save all that money. I don't pay you benefits. And what do you have to do? You have to then go get a second or even third part-time job. Well, are you working more than 40 hours a week? Well, you ask people who have two or more part-time jobs whether they are. And absolutely they are. They might have been previously working 35, 40 hours a week and being able to survive on that. But now when they're working 20 hours a week, they have to cobble together two or three jobs. They're working a longer work day. Yeah, it just happens to be for two capitalists, right? Or three capitalists. But for that worker, it's a longer, they're lengthening the work day, right? Just as they lengthen the work day for professionals, right? Professionals take their work home. They work over the weekend. You know, a good example is teachers. An example of teachers, right? The trend in teaching has been, and there's millions of teachers in this country, has been to get the teachers to work after they leave school. They got to do counseling now, of course, and they lay off the counselors, see? So they get the teachers to do the counseling. The teachers have to do tutoring for students who aren't doing so well. Then they come home and they have to do the grading of their class, right? Teachers work 12, 14 hours a day. Yeah, their wages haven't risen, but they're working 12, 14 hours a day, more and more. Well, that goes on in the private sector too, right? They lay off people and give the workers even more tasks for to do in addition to what they did, right? Well, that's an example of, as well, of relative surplus value intensification, right? So the reduction of paid vacation, holiday, sick leave days, right? Weekend work. How about commute time? As workers have been pushed out of the inner city more and more, or leave, their commutes are longer and longer. That's the work day. That's part of the extension of the work day. You know, workers used to be able to walk down the street and go to work, but not anymore. They commute from the suburbs. You know, here in California, long commutes, sometimes 2 hours one way to get to work. Well, that's a kind of extension of the work day, right? Prep time. Preparing for work in a number of occupations is often not paid, right? Other examples what about unpaid internships? You know, it's really a crime that now in tech particular, more and more young people trying to get a job work for nothing. They go and work for nothing for the summer or longer. Unpaid internships. And some of these companies really exploit this. You know, they sort of lead these people on to think, well, work for us for 3 months. We're going to see what you do. And then, you know, we'll hire you. Well, all they do is keep turning over that group more and more. You know, 3 months. Well, let's get another crop in here and we'll get them to work for free for 3 months. And that's an exemption that's looked the other way by the government of the minimum wage laws. Right. Okay, so work at home, telecommuting. You know, some people think that, okay, they're working less, but work at home telecommuting usually means longer hours in your job than actually coming to work. Whether it's longer because you're not commuting is another question, right? Offshoring of jobs. Capitalism has moved a lot of these jobs offshore to the third world, right? In places where workers are once again Indonesia making Nike shoes, working 12-hour days, you see, and paying them even more. In other words, you get a double hit for a capitalist moving the jobs offshore, right? You get them to work longer, and the socially necessary labor is much less. You pay them much less, as well as work them longer. So commute time, teachers, unpaid, tasks being added, offshoring, working at home, telecommuting, a reduction of paid time off, substitute it with comp time, workers on call, not getting paid on call, reducing overtime pay by exempting people, right? Expanding part-time jobs. You know, there's at least 50, 60 million of the 160 million labor force in the U.S. who are part-time temp gig workers. Gig working being the latest extension. You could say, most of these drivers, Uber drivers, don't drive 8 hours a day. Most of them have another job. Plus, they drive 4 or 5 hours a day on top of it. It's usually a second job. See, so they're extending the workday. Well, why did they start driving Uber? Because they haven't got a raise in their primary job, which is usually part-time, for quite some time. Contemporary, you can look, and what we see is this lengthening of the workday in various ways going on. Not the absolute saying, okay, you know, you're going to work 12 hours now. No, there's more subtle ways they get around it. Multiple subtle ways they get around it, that results in an extension of the workday on a social average. If you look at the whole workforce, the whole society, right? And the big causes, of course, are getting around overtime pay, exempting people, converting jobs to part-time, and then people having multiple jobs. In order to survive, moving jobs offshore, because capitalism is a global phenomenon, right? Getting professionals to work longer hours, more commute time. These are all examples of how today the workday has been increasing for large numbers of workers of various kinds. Therefore, absolute surplus value extraction has been increasing today, especially since 1980, because a lot of these developments I talked about have really evolved under neoliberalism since 1980. And of course, when we get to relative surplus value, we see an even greater increase in extraction of surplus from the workers. Relative surplus value, making workers work faster, intensifying, and or producing more of what they make in the given work time that they have. That, of course, is automation. automation, as we used to call it, right? But automation is really substituting labor for capital. That's really what automation is, intensifying, using machinery. And you don't have to say industrial machinery. I mean, we're not talking about lathes and drill presses and so forth here, substituting workers, although you have numerical control machines who are doing, you know, just that. I mean, look what's happening, has happened for decades now in auto production, right? A lot of the auto production tasks, the assembling, are done by robots. Yeah, you've all seen pictures of the a whole production line of robots, you know, welding, and one worker there just overlooking the machine, the numerical control machine, to make sure that everything functions well. Well, you know, that means that scores and hundreds of workers have been thrown off that production line that used to do that welding and other activities. Well, that's occurring everywhere, you see, everywhere. That's a real phenomenon. And the machinery here, machinery is not just physical pieces of iron, right? Machinery is software. Software machines are displacing people at an even greater rate. And this trend is about to accelerate. In fact, it is already accelerating as a result of COVID. What we got artificial intelligence, which is going to displace 30% of the occupations by the end of this decade. Yes, and a lot of them, the service jobs. Simple decisions will be made by software and not by actual workers. So we're throwing more and more people out into the workplace, out of the workplace, or forcing them to work a couple more part-time jobs here or there. That's relative surplus value, intensifying productivity, making people work even faster, more productively, producing more things. Software code going to be done by software robots, right? Throwing a lot of these programmers out of jobs. All this is happening now, even more intensely, even more rapidly. Relative surplus value is increasing even faster than absolute surplus value extraction. Exploitation is rising intensely everywhere. The wages and the benefits of workers are not rising as fast, if rising at all. That's the reality of capitalism. Greater surplus value extraction going on, right? Everywhere, intensely. And we'll talk next week about how it's not now only occurring in the production process, but it's occurring post-production, or what Marx would call secondary exploitation. That's intensifying too. Okay, that's the analysis of how capitalism extracts surplus labor, intensifying surplus value here like never before. Next week, what about the critics of this whole process? And what about Marxist economists who I will say are not really economists and scientists, they are philologists who treat Volume 1 of Capital like a Bible. Okay, so next week we'll conclude Marx and look at its critics, both pro and con.